Maybe you had to make a choice in your own life between doing something for a lot of money or doing something that paid a lot less but was much more meaningful. That's the choice today's guest made. Adam Braun might have been a Wall Street big shot, but he chose instead to start a nonprofit called Pencils for Promise, building schools and training teachers and educating kids in many parts of the world. Adam Braun is now in demand as a speaker at conferences, universities, and even big corporations. His book about his journey is called The Promise of a Pencil, How an Ordinary Person Can Create Extraordinary Change. Adam Braun's our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. Adam, thanks for being here.
Oh, my pleasure. Really a pleasure to be here.
So you write in the book, we have the ability to provide quality education to every child on Earth right now. What stops us?
Well, I think that part of it is just truly an issue around resource distribution. Right now we have, as I mentioned, the ability to educate every single child on Earth. We're not looking for a mystery vaccine. We're not looking to dig for a mineral that may or may not be there or draw something out of the environment. If you really think about it from a logical standpoint, we have every resource necessary to educate every single child as it stands right now. It's just about getting education into the places where it's most challenging. And I genuinely believe in my lifetime that we will accomplish that.
Is it a deliberate thing, or is it just that the challenges are more physical and remoteness and things like that, or technology? I mean, what are some of the major obstacles?
Well, in some parts of the world, it is deliberate, unfortunately. It's smaller parts, but there's areas in the Middle East that purposely restrict women from getting access to education, because then, obviously, education unlocks opportunity, self-empowerment. And so there's a couple places where, they purposely restrict people. But the vast majority, right now there's 57 million children without any form of educational access. Then there's another 250 million who go to school every day but can't read or write their own name by the end of fourth or fifth grade. So there's issues around access and quality. But the majority of it is, truthfully, for lack of a better term, neglect. It's the individuals who have access to bring it to others. To empower other individuals to have the tools to self-educate, just not seeing it as a pressing enough issue and not making a case for pushing forward to make it happen.
The second number is daunting itself, but the first one's even more staggering. 57 million children no access to education, period?
Correct.
Wow.
Yeah, completely out of school.
That's amazing. Each chapter in your book is a mantra. Did this become something of a spiritual quest for you?
I wouldn't even say it became a spiritual quest. It's just the way that I've kind of viewed the lens of my life has always been through, I guess, kind of, I don't know if spiritual is the right word, but just recognition that there's, more than recognition for me, it's almost knowledge. I just can't justify that this world that we live in, which I look at with such incredible awe, it's just so staggering to me that all of this exists. It's hard for me to imagine that this exists without some type of purpose, some type of reason for my existence within it, as well as every other individual's. I mean, I fundamentally believe that every single person has a distinct purpose. And so mantras are probably the best phrase that I could come up with to capture these ideas. But what I've realized is that over time, I've just found essential truths. That's really what I think of them as. They're short, pithy phrases that capture some element of absolute profound truth. And they might not always resonate for every single individual, but when you find something that hits you and at that point in your life you say, wow, this is really true, they become really helpful to help to guide us almost as guideposts in the weighted decisions that we have to make in our lives. And so, when I thought about how people consume media nowadays, my take on it is that we want almost episodes. Like, if we're going to listen to short stories, we like The Moth, or we like TED Talks because they're episodic. Or, people watch on Netflix nowadays, they watch House of Cards or Game of Thrones on HBO, or, 24 before that. Or, we like episodes. And so I almost wanted to write the book in an episodic nature. And I thought, well, more than just writing an inspiring story, let me provide almost a how-to so that people don't finish the book feeling like, oh, well, that was inspiring, but I have no idea how to go out and create my own extraordinary journey. I really wanted to equip people with the exact guideposts and the guiding steps to live a life of both success and significance. And the things that have always helped me were these short phrases that I call mantras. And so every chapter is titled with one of the mantras, and then the chapter itself is a short story that illustrates it in action.
And by examples, there are chapters named Every Pencil Holds a Promise, Tourists See, Travelers Seek, Embrace the lightning moments. Big dreams start with small, unreasonable acts. We'll have to ask about that one. Practice humility over hubris. These are some of the chapter titles in Adam Braun's book, The Promise of a Pencil. You were not planning this career when you first started thinking about career choices along about high school, it sounds like.
Right. No, I was thinking a very, very different path. I wanted to work in finance. Desperately wanted to work on Wall Street.
So your dad, you mentioned in the book, he taught you a lot, but sternly, it sounds like. What motivated him?
Well, he was the child of two Holocaust survivors. So my grandmother, on my dad's side, was 14 when she was taken out of school on the Hungarian countryside and shipped off to Auschwitz with her 12-year-old sister, her mother, and 26 other family members. Every one of them was killed the first night. When they arrived in the camps, she was deemed to be of working age, and so she was essentially the lone survivor. And through a series of miracles, spent 14 months in concentration camps and truly as a survivor. Very similar story on my dad's side. He was in Dachau for a year, lost both his brothers and his father. And so my dad came to this country on a boat as a three-year-old landed in New York City. They grew up in Queens in a small little apartment, and so he was kind of a rough and tumble city kid, but he was very, very motivated to create a better life for his family.
You'll hear how well he did when we return to the interview in a few moments. Adam Braun is the founder of Pencils of Promise and the author of the book, The Promise of a Pencil. He visited in May of 2014 to talk about his encounter with a boy who wanted a pencil. It all grew from there. We'll hear the rest of the story when we return to the exchange shortly. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on Jefferson Public Radio's News and Information Service. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. We're revisiting an interview from 3 years ago. Adam Braun wrote a book about meeting a little boy in India who wanted a pencil. Think of it as symbolic for him wanting an education. Adam Braun stepped up, not just with the pencil, but with an organization that built hundreds of schools all over the world. His book is The Promise of a Pencil. Since the interview was from 2014, we can't take any new phone calls today. I want to finish the thought about your father and what motivated him. He was the child of Holocaust survivors, and he was a bit of a rough-and-tumble city kid, as you pointed out.
Yeah, absolutely. And so, the biggest thing that we were kind of reinforced as children growing up was this one phrase. Before he went to sleep every single night, he would say, "Hey, just remember, Braun's are different, my last name." And he wasn't trying to tell us that we were better than anybody else or superior. It was just that we had to hold ourselves to a different standard from what everyone else around us adhered to. And so that eventually kind of came to pass when kids around us maybe started getting, like $10 for getting an A, or they had a Nintendo and we didn't. And we'd always kind of, start to complain and say, "Well, Johnny has this, or Stacy has that. How come I don't have this too?" And he would just look at us and say, "Well, that's because Braun's are different." But then eventually, when we started to act within the value system that they wanted us to operate within, which would mean if a kid was getting bullied and we stood up for him or her and said, "That's not right." And we would come home and we would tell him, my dad would say, "You know why you did that, right?" And we'd say, "Why?" I say, "Well, because Braun's are different." And, we almost kind of developed what felt like armor as kids, that, okay, well, we're different because this is our last name and this is the lineage that we come from. And I really think any parent can do it. And interestingly, I was reading an article in the New York Times a couple of weeks ago written by a friend of mine who's an author, Adam Grant, wrote a great book that was also a New York Times bestseller called Give and Take. And it was all about how to raise a moral child. And the takeaway was that it's actually not about rewarding behavior and telling a kid, if they do something nice, to say, "Wow, that was a really nice act." But it's actually about building identity. And so you're more likely to keep a child acting in a morale fashion by saying, "You know why you did that? Because you're a nice person," rather than saying, "That was a really nice act that you did." And strangely, when I read that, I thought that was a lot of my upbringing, was building an identity rather than just rewarding action.
Hmm. Bronze are different, but so it certainly stung a bit at first, but made a lot more sense later on, huh?
Yeah, exactly. We hated it early on.
The names Sam and Cornelio appear early in the book, and they loom fairly large in your story. Who were they?
So Sam and Cornelio are my two adopted brothers. When I was entering my senior year in high school, I actually played on an all-star basketball team with them. I was a big basketball player, and they were just two really great, sweet, humble, you know, just dignified kids. But they're originally from Mozambique, and they had been duped into a false American education. Essentially told, if you give us $1,000, we'll get you into a school, and it was really a fake school. And so we met them. They told us their story. It really resonated with my dad as somebody who had pursued his own American dream. And then my brother showed him around town and took him to New York, and they ended up seeing our public high school, and kind of their eyes lit up and just said, this is why we came here, to get education in a place like this. And so my parents kind of sat me down and said, look, this is going to be on you. You're going to have to really drive them around and tutor and assimilate them entering your senior year, because my brother was in college. My sister was just entering her freshman year of high school, but it was a no-brainer. And so we took them in, and now it's been, I guess, 13 or 14 years, but they're my two brothers, and they're from Mozambique, and they just opened my eyes up to how different the rest of the world lives from kind of what we experience just in Western culture.
All right, so it all sort of comes full circle now, because the obvious question here is most people in Greenwich, Connecticut do expect to work on Wall Street someday, perhaps. It's a very wealthy community, but bronze are different.
Right.
But
right.
You did expect to work on Wall Street someday, didn't you?
Oh, completely. I mean, it's kind of funny how I came to it, which is I loved collecting basketball cards. And the one thing that I wanted more than anything in life was a Michael Jordan basketball card. I just loved Jordan as a kid. But the Jordan cards were always the most expensive. And so what I realized is that if I could get an Iverson, an Allen Iverson, who was coming up as a great college player into the pros, I could basically trade it as he got better in the league for a Charles Barkley, who was kind of diminishing, and then maybe I could find a big Charles Barkley fan and trade that Barkley for the Michael Jordan. And so one of my coaches saw this and explained to me, you know, I do this for a living, Adam. It's just called picking stocks. And so I thought, wow, well, that sounds cool. And I was competitive, but I was a math and numbers kid, so started to learn about Wall Street and just became obsessed. And so when I was 13, I opened up an E-Trade account. By the time I was 16, I was working at a hedge fund, and by the time I was 19, I was working at a fund of funds. And so was definitely on a fast track to a Wall Street career, had been on the floor of the New York Stock Exchange, just loved it, was on that path, you know, went to Brown University, was playing basketball, but had a couple majors, but the main one I was interested in was economics, so I could go work in finance. And then everything kind of changed when I was 21 and went on semester at sea for the first time.
All right, so that was your first big step into the rest of the world. And talk about rude awakenings. Hoo-wee. Tell us about that voyage.
Sure. So, you know, there's a 50-year history of semester at sea, very rich, incredible history, at least two voyages a year, so over 100 voyages. And you know, I went on one of the three famous voyages, and the truth is you don't get famous on semester at sea when things go right. It's when it goes wrong that people learn about your ship. And so my voyage left from Vancouver, headed towards South Korea in January of 2005, and we got caught in between three major storm fronts. And one of the paths that we tried to take, essentially we went south, another storm developed underneath us, kind of created this perfect superstorm. That led to a 60-foot rogue wave, which hit us head-on. And it went over the top of our ship, and it flooded the area with the navigational equipment, and we lost all power to our engines while in 45-foot swells. And so this panicked announcement came telling us to get to our muster stations, which is where you evacuate the ship from. And so I was sure I was dying within about an hour, because it's freezing cold water outside, so there's really no evacuation. And within that, I just kind of had to almost evaluate, well, I can't believe I'm about to die. Why was I here in the first place? And then you kind of move along this very quick linear progression to what will I leave behind? And it's actually not about the possessions. It's almost about the footprint that you've left behind. And I realized that I didn't have a particularly good or big footprint. And fortunately, obviously, we survived. But from that point forward, I've really been pretty obsessed with how do I create the most amount of impact that I can while I'm here, but ultimately the type of impact that will endure and last after I'm gone. And the only way that you can do that is through impacting others, not just your own life. And I kind of had to realize, well, whatever physical possessions I can amass, if they're not going to be carried on and sustained by others, then they are going to disappear. And so it really changed the direction of my life. And about a month later, I found myself in rural India, asking one child in each country that I went through, what do you want most in the world? And I have him write it down. And this boy begging on the streets of India surprised me and said that if he could have anything, he would want a pencil. And so I gave him my pencil and he lit up. And from that point forward, I was just kind of a man on fire about access to education for all.
What was the source of asking the question in the first place? What do you want most in the world?
Well, I think it was just driven by partially the fact that I was on semester at sea, which, you know, every student kind of has a shtick. It's like you get a hat in each country, you get a beer bottle, or, you know, you take a photo with, like, a Beanie Baby in front of a monument. Everyone just had their one thing. And I'd always really enjoyed working with kids, and I just thought it would be an interesting kind of, you know, social psychology experiment. You know, what do the kids of the world really want? And I'm about to be in 10 different countries, so I can actually get a sense of it. And I also thought that I could create probably some cool collage in my college dorm room when I got back with the answers. And that's really what motivated me to begin with.
Adam Braun is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. He's the author of the book, The Promise of a Pencil, How an Ordinary Person Can Create Extraordinary Change. And you just heard the details of where the title of the book comes from and the name of his nonprofit. He calls it a for-purpose, Pencils for Promise. So why did the kid want the pencil?
Well, as I started to probe, what I learned was that he had never been to school before. And so when he looked around, he saw other children with pens and pencils and notepads. But as a street beggar, one of the things that you learn before going there is that oftentimes children, they're actually overseen by either parents, tragically, or are most often kind of gang lords. And those gang lords will put them out on the street. And if you give them money, it actually perpetuates the cycle because it makes them a successful beggar. And so the individual will keep them out there longer. And so, you know, if you give the child money, it was just going to get taken away from him and keep him on the street. And I think that oftentimes we find incredible amounts of profound wisdom within the words of children. It's almost disarming how wise a child's simplistic answer can actually be in illustrating a fundamental truth to an adult. And his answer, wanting a pencil, it was like he wanted to unlock a sense of creativity. He wanted to have some personal exploration, some personal freedom. And I think somewhere within that answer was the acknowledgement that even as a child, he could recognize the value of self-education.
So after seeing the world through semester at sea, including getting to the Ganges River in Varanasi, I mean, how different was your view of the United States when you got home?
Well, that was actually the biggest cultural shock. Everyone kind of said to me, well, which country was the biggest culture shock for you? And there was no doubt, it wasn't even close. It was returning to the United States with new eyes. And it took a long time to adjust. And I think for a lot of people, when they go into the developing world and they have a true kind of immersion-based experience, you know, not just like a day or two looking at sites, but they actually spend quality time getting to know the people and see the way of life that they go through day in and day out, it's very tough to kind of reconcile a lot of the ways of life that we have here. And, you know, especially as a 21-year-old, I think I was kind of almost like self-righteous in my views, which took a long time to come to a middle ground of saying, look, you know, not everyone's seen this stuff. Not everyone has to view the world in the same way that I do. And also, it's not sustainable myself to live a life where I feel bad for every little thing that I do. And eventually, it actually really shifted when there's a story in the book in a chapter called Tourist See, Traveler Seek, where I met a man who asked me to come stay with him in his home. In the mountains of Guatemala when I was 23. And I ended up staying with him, and it's a much longer story, but I realized that he wanted me to help him gain the tools to self-educate, which I was able to, but that he was in the same situation that my grandfather or my great-grandfather were in, living in a rural countryside, as was probably every single person who would be listening to this. Within 3 to 4 generations, your family lived on a rural countryside as well. But it was somebody who made a level of self-sacrifice to get you to where you are right now. And we are actually in a unique position to honor the sacrifices of those who came before us by paying it forward. And that really started to change my view from a feeling of guilt and obligation to why was I born into a nice, comfortable life with, you know, a supportive American culture when these people weren't, And instead say, you know, I know why I was born into this life, because somebody else made a conscious decision to get me here, my ancestors, my lineage. And there's somebody else out there who wants that for their grandchildren, and the best thing I can do is to pay it forward and provide them with some of that access so that their family generations down the line can have the same life that we all strive for.
And with these revelations and the new range of experiences you were having, I can understand your brain would be exploding with ideas, but why did you fill out a will at age 23? You made your mother cry, you know.
I did. That was that was maybe something, looking back in retrospect, I wish I almost hadn't done. But, you know, after I went through that wave experience on Semester at Sea, you know, I was very aware of my own mortality. And when I went off into South America on this four-month backpacking trip from Guatemala down to Argentina and back up, I knew that I was going to be going through pretty dangerous parts of the world. And the night that I was leaving, the friend of mine who was supposed to travel with me for the first 2 months bailed. And I decided, you know, I'm still going forward with it, but now I'm going to be alone. And I didn't bring a guidebook. By that time, I had kind of backpacked a fair amount, but I believed in listening to the advice of locals and other travelers. And I really thought, you know, so I might not make it back, and I don't have very much, but I want to leave the little that I have to this one organization, the Cambodian Children's Fund, that I loved at the time and still do. I think I left my music to, like, my sister, and my journals to my brother, and very, very little things. But it was important to me, and I was in recognition that, you know, any single day could be my last, but hopefully I would live fully within that knowledge.
How much did your perceptions of poverty and charity change in this time in your life?
Immensely. Completely. I think that we have this traditional view around charity and poverty, which is that for one reason or another, we are in a position to help out those who are less fortunate. And in doing so, we not only create good in our life and in theirs, which is actually the right perception. Where it starts to go wrong is somehow this ideology that we have to lift them up rather than give them the tools to lift themselves up. And if you look at time and time again how people got themselves out of poverty, it was by them making a critical decision to do so. It wasn't because somebody gave them a handout and they just kind of rested on their laurels and said, oh, well, I'm just going to keep on getting handouts. That type of approach just does not lift individuals out of poverty. And yet that's kind of the pervasive idea around charity, that it's a one-way value exchange, that those who have more give to those who have less. And it almost kind of keeps those who have less in that cycle of dependence. And so when I spent time with just community after community, but in particular this one experience with that man, Joel, in the mountains of Guatemala, where he asked me to read his Bible into a large tape cassette recorder, and I did it for hours and hours over a three-day period. You know, most people say, why you do that? Well, the answer is because he had a large set of headphones, and he had taught himself to read English, but he couldn't pronounce it. And so he wanted to listen to my voice every night to learn how to pronounce the words so he could teach them to his children, who could teach them to his eventual grandchildren. And I realized, wow, I mean, these people have the same exact ambition, the same exact latent potential as any other individual. It's just about giving them the tools to self-educate. And so that's really the kind of foundation of the organization, Pencils of Promise, that I eventually started, which was giving others the tools to self-educate, but not treating them as less than us and that they need favors, but putting it in their hands. And then if they don't adopt it, if they don't kind of take it and go run with it and maximize that opportunity, then we choose not to work in that area or with that community.
Did you have to make some decisions about what age groups to focus on? I mean, Joel's not a young man, right?
Yeah. I mean, we've made a lot of critical decisions. So eventually, I mean, in starting Pencils of Promise, I left a really great job at Bain & Company.
So the fact that you did do the Wall Street gig then?
Yeah. So I went down that path. I mean, I worked at an institutional bank. I worked at GE Commercial Finance for a little bit. And then I went over to Bain on the consulting side. But, you know, 80% of Bain Capital employees are former Bain consultants. And so it was kind of the entree into private equity and hedge fund land. And I was getting calls from headhunters saying, all right, well, you know, your first year compensation is going to be around $250,000. And I was, I think, 24, 25 years old. It was kind of a strange situation, kind of a crazy situation to be in. But eventually, you know, turned that down and started building Pencils of Promise with $25 and giving up my birthday and saying, you know, this year I'd like donations in lieu of gifts because I wanted to build one school. And dedicated and honor my grandmother and create a tangible impact. And fortunately, obviously, the organization has grown tremendously. We've now broken ground on more than 200 schools around the world with more than 22,000 students. But along the way, I mean, we really, as you said, we had to make some tough decisions. And that meant focusing on primary age students, focusing just in 3 to 4 countries in Latin America, Asia, and Africa. I mean, it's been tough, but the truth is it's the for-profit business acumen that I have in my background that's enabled us to succeed, because I don't look at this work as charitable work. I look at it as a business. And yes, we're a 501c3 nonprofit, but I like the phrase for purpose just because I think it applies more to the work. I don't think anyone wakes up and says, today, I can't wait to not profit.
Right.
Nobody says that. They wake up and they say, today, I want to lift others out of poverty by increasing profitability in their life. Or they say, I want to increase the sense of meaning and purpose in my own. And it's usually a combination of the two. And so that's what drives us.
Pencils of Promise is indeed identified not as nonprofit, but as for purpose. Adam Braun created it. He joined us on The Exchange 3 years ago. The rest of the interview coming up in a little more than a minute here on Jefferson Public Radio. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Adam Braun visited in 2014 to talk about his encounter with a boy in India who wanted a pencil. He got that. And a school. Adam Braun's organization has built hundreds of schools. He tells the story in The Promise of a Pencil. It's a story of going from Wall Street guy to school builder. And since it's a story from a couple of years ago, we're not taking any new phone calls today. I want to make it clear that as much as people may malign the name Bain and Company where you work, if they are aware of the connection to Mitt Romney in the last presidential campaign, the fact is they actually kind of helped push you into this, what you're doing now.
Yeah, oh, absolutely. I mean, you know, there's no way the Pencils of Promise would be anywhere close to where it is without the, not only the training, but, you know, the kind of the launching pad that Bain has provided and the support that they've, you know, given along the way. I'm still one of the Bain directors is on my board, and they'll let us use office space, and you know, this year we'll actually help build their first school.
You tell us in the book to embrace the lightning moments. What was your big lightning moment?
Well, mine was actually the night that I decided to start the organization. I went to the New York Philharmonic. I'd never been to a symphony, and one of my coworkers got tickets, so I was able to go, and I just stood there, kind of in awe, as this one man came out and played this incredible piano piece, and he was just playing with such fervor. Such commitment, and the whole room was kind of enraptured by this man's playing. And I looked at him, and I thought, you know, if I could find anything that I was as passionate about that gave me as much of a sense of purpose as this man feels towards his piano, that would be really, you know, alive. That would give me a sense of just lightning, almost like lightning bolt in my life. And this name, Pencils of Promise, popped in my head, and I literally kind of in that moment realized, oh my gosh, I can use what's called Bain's externship program to go start an organization. I can find a way to build one school dedicated to my grandmother. And it was like a bolt of electricity went through me. I mean, I was just like buzzing. And that was the night that I went home. I wrote out our mission statement, our charter, and 10 days later went to the bank and started the organization from there. And so I think a lot of times people have these moments where it feels like you have some epiphany, some breakthrough, and you realize the way that your life could be if you pursued what seems like a very maybe risky or non-traditional path. But if you have that kind of electricity in your skin and in your bones, I would, you know, encourage any person to pursue that because they're rare, but they lead you in the right direction time and time again.
And to reinforce the message of humble beginnings and baby steps at first, I mean, you went to the bank and opened the first account for Pencils of Promise with $25, wasn't it?
Yeah. I asked the lady at Bank of America, what does it take to open a new account? I have this idea. She said, well, at Bank of America, you have to start with at least $25 to open a new account. And I thought, well, I don't have much, and that's a good sign because I'm turning 25 this month. So Pencils of Promise started with literally $25 in a bank account and now has raised tens of millions of dollars since.
So who joined in with you? I mean, how did you get the momentum built for Pencils for Promise?
So the very start was birthdays. So I just realized that I need more birthday gifts and that I could ask friends to give donations instead of birthday presents. And then the second thing that I realized was that if all things are equal between either a product, a brand, or a service, and one of those two creates a positive social impact with 84% frequency, people will switch. And one of the most common things that's capable and accessible for any individual in New York is what to do with your Friday or your Saturday night. And so I thought, well, if I can create an event that's just as good, but I can, you know, enable people to help build a school, then they'll probably come out. And so we started organizing these low-dollar events, like, you know, $20 to $50 maybe, to get in for young professionals in New York. And you could meet great people. And there was almost a positivity to it, knowing that all proceeds from the night go to, you know, supporting, helping build a school. And that's how we started. In 2008 and 2009, 98% of the donations were in amounts of $100 or less from young people and almost entirely from these events. And I really focused on building a community. And then, because I was Mark Zuckerberg's year in college and essentially a beta tester for Facebook and the whole wave of early social media platforms, we as an organization kind of anticipated the rise of digital and social media as well as the rise of cause marketing and kind of positioned ourselves as, you know, maybe we didn't have the most money, maybe we didn't have the you know, most authoritative board of directors because we were all kind of young at the start, but we would build one of the largest social media followings in the space. And with that, we could command value from brands and companies that wanted to build partnerships. And so in 2010, that's when we started to grow really quickly because of that. And then in 2011 and since, now major philanthropists look at our work and say, well, this is some of the most effective philanthropic spend on my dollar. And then secondly, this is the one organization that I found that my kids love. And so I can instill philanthropic values in them through their work with the organization. And so almost strangely, as much as I didn't expect it, our core now is families. It's really the family unit that knows, hey, if I find a way to fund or fundraise, whether it's to train a teacher, which is $500, or provide a scholarship, which is $250, or all the way up to $25,000, which builds a full school, then I can create a value system for my family. And anyone that funds a full school or fundraises, which you can do on pencilsofpromise.org, create a really nice custom page to share with friends and family that'll donate right there. We take you on a trip into the field, and so you can go to Guatemala or Ghana or Laos with your kids. And dedicate a school to a loved one or the family or any business as well.
Did you? You must have found a space then that was not already being served. I mean, I have to believe there are other organizations that are building schools and training teachers overseas. So, where did you find the niche for Pencils of Promise?
Well, there's a few things. One is that a lot of people do individual programs, but we are one of the few that has kind of the holistic educational track covered. So, we start with building schools, and it's heavily through community engagement. About 20% of the funding for every school comes from the community itself. As I mentioned before, these aren't handouts. They're for each individual to own and sustain as a community. And so the way they make it up is through materials and labor. So 20% of funding doesn't come because they have cash. It comes from the fact that they're willing to work on building their actual school. So they make up that percentage of the project proposal through mainly labor. But then we also layer it on teacher training. We layer it on student scholarships so that when kids complete our primary schools, we'll provide a scholarship for them to continue on to secondary school. And now we're doing what's called innovation pilots, which are really testing out what the future of education can look like with everything from e-readers in classrooms to using 3D printers in rural Laos to produce literacy toolkits to long-distance radio programming in Guatemala to reach the most underserved and removed populations and get greater storytelling to their kids.
In some cases, do you have advantages, Adam Braun, because you're working in fairly remote and very underserved places? I mean, there's the whole concept of not hopscotching. I forget the term at the moment, but where we're basically skipping over the next generation of technology. You're going from 1 to 3. So, for example, companies that didn't have phone systems are getting into cell phone systems easily because they're not going through the wired systems first.
Exactly. Yeah, I mean, strangely, we actually have a couple of very big advantages. One of them is our dollar just stretches much further and impacts many more lives than you would be able to see in most other environments. So the idea that, you know, you would try and build a school, let's say here or in most Western countries, is going to cost you several million dollars. You're going to have to get land, obviously a tremendous amount of permits, then the construction costs a ton. Once it's opened, if you wanted to try new and innovative ideas, you're going to have to fight against teachers' unions, labor unions, and government entrenched programs. Where we work for $25,000, we not only build a full school, but because we have really strong relationships with the education ministry and primarily local staff, we're able to test out new innovation and technology because they're so excited for it and they've never had any other opportunity to access something like that. And so, you know, if you think about if suddenly your kid's school was one of three schools in its district, and they got e-readers for every child. The neighboring two schools would be in an uproar, and whoever was the kind of council person in that area, you know, would be hearing it. The teachers' unions would start fighting within one another. When we put e-readers into classrooms in Ghana in the coming month, there is going to be excitement for the idea that it is being used at all. It's going to be significantly cheaper than doing it in any other geography. And if it works, there'll be excitement in neighboring communities because it'll get rolled out very quickly. And so we can really leapfrog from one to three, to your point, which is one of the reasons that I think a lot of philanthropists who actually want to impact domestic education are excited to fund the work of Pencils of Promise, because they know that if we prove it out in these environments, we can do it at larger scale, lower dollar, more efficiency than anywhere else. And if it works, then it can get adopted here at home.
So they become laboratories, in essence, for things that could work anywhere in the world.
Yeah, that's why we're calling them innovation pilots.
So, but how much follow-up is done? I mean, because I imagine you have to, you know, carefully look at the landscape that you're coming into and gauge the ability of this community to sustain the schools that you build, to make sure that you don't come back in 2 years and all the e-readers are broken and the kids are back to using, drawing stuff in the dirt.
Right, well, more than 70, so our staff is almost, the vast majority of it is in-country. So we have about 15 here in New York, but then we have 75 global staff who live in-country, and the key is that more than 90% of them are from the country itself. So it's Guatemalan staff working with Guatemalan kids on the countryside, and most of the staff is from that kind of rural environment themselves. So every time that we open up a new school, a staff member is essentially directly mapped and connected to that one community. It's their job to oversee the well-being of the students, the teachers, and the school. And they're in that community anywhere from three times a month to bare minimum quarterly.
You make a reference in the book to the difference between a lunatic and a leader. What is that difference, and what assessment have you made about yourself, or is that still an open question?
I think I sit between the two. But there's really only one simple difference between a lunatic and a leader, and that the difference is that a leader has at least one person who follows them. And oftentimes, that builds into a larger movement. But they both have to start out saying, I see the world completely differently than anyone else, and I think that this is where things will go. And what happens is lunatics just kind of stay off by themselves, raving about something that everyone else says they're crazy. But what happens with leaders is they say, I think the world's going here, and at least one person says, I believe you, and I want to support making this vision real. And then eventually that transfers into a broader movement, but it's essential for, real leadership skills to gain the ability to communicate in a persuasive way that enables others to follow. And there's a mantra in the book called Find the Impossible Ones. Because when I started out this organization, especially as young as I was, in a challenging economic period, everyone would say to me, it's going to be impossible. Over and over, oh, this is nice, Adam, I really respect it, but it's impossible. You have to take a different approach. And eventually I realized, something, there's a lot of power in being the underdog. The reason that we watch March Madness is not to watch the number one play against the number one in the finals. It's the hopes that the number, 15 beats the number two in the opening round and can somehow make it in to that, quote, Cinderella story. And so I thought, something, let's build a movement around being the underdog. Let's celebrate that. And so we created a brand within Pencils of Promise called The Impossible Ones. So if someone went to pencilsofpromise.org right now, they would see a question, are you an impossible one? And we really started to rally around the idea that people say what we're trying to do is impossible. So let's find the people who get inspired by that and say, I want to try. And that's been a real large part of our success thus far, is building out a community of people who want to do things that others will deem impossible.
Well, it's clear, Adam, that you're not easily daunted by obstacles, pressure, et cetera. But you've faced some significant ones, it sounds like, particularly with Laos, when you decided wanted to do things. So how did you overcome some of those obstacles, and what were they?
I think there's been a lot of obstacles. One of them, obviously, is just going into a foreign environment that you've never been in before and trying to figure it out from the ground up. And I think part of it is, truthfully, the willingness to fail. There's two chapters in the book, actually three, that are just about failure. Practice humility over hubris, another one called vulnerability is vital, and a third one called fess up to your failures. And in putting out the book, I wasn't sure, what was going to happen. I was blown away when it debuted at number two on the New York Times bestseller list and then stayed on the bestseller list throughout the entire month of March and into early April. But the feedback consistently has been this one statement, which is, it's a book that's about how to not only succeed, but deal with failure and find, the way forward within your failures. And Strangely, I actually decided just before the book was coming out to take out the chapter called Fess Up to Your Failure, because I won't ruin it for anyone that's going to read this out there, but it's really about me being a total jerk. I just made a series of bad mistakes as a leader, and I thought I was supporting my organization, but I was really actually hurting the people within the organization, thinking, I'm going to protect pencils of promise, and in the process hurt some of our greatest leadership members, but they can deal with it, because this is about the organization's long-term trajectory, and I really messed up. And just before the book came out, I decided, I'm taking that chapter out. I just don't want to look like a jerk in front of the mass public and however many people decide to read this. And the few people that have read it thus far, about a dozen, I shared, I'm taking out the Fess Up to Your Failures chapter. I'm taking it out of the book. And they said to me, everyone, no, that was my favorite chapter in the book because it demonstrated that you're human and that you make mistakes just like each of us. And you talk about how within your failures are the greatest opportunities of growth. I think there's this like beautiful metaphor in the fact that anytime someone fires an arrow, they have to pull it back first so it can spring forward. I just learned time and time again that every time that I failed, rather than to get dejected by it, to treat it as, okay, here's a fissure, here's a break in something. And within that break, there's an opportunity to mend this so that it can become stronger than ever before.
Step across the gap, as it were, and pick things up on the other side. It's a new land.
Yeah. Completely.
Adam Braun has been our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. His book is The Promise of a Pencil, How an Ordinary Person Can Create Extraordinary Change. You can find the website for his organization at pencilsofpromise.org. Adam, thanks so much for joining us today on the Exchange.
My pleasure.